90s sitcom Friends has had far-reaching cultural impact over the decades, finding itself at the centre of rolling fashion trends and loads of scholarly analysis. But Elizabeth Stokoe found the popular television series intriguing for the way it subverted everyday conversation for the sake of comedy. Stokoe, who is a professor of social interaction at Loughborough University, was inspired by the show to research interactional breaches in conversation to get laughs. Her ongoing work also involves a collection of conversations in the wild, like that of people on first dates or being questioned by police. More recently, Elizabeth has been looking at how COVID-19 pandemic has been or has affected the art of conversation, especially as we increasingly communicate via digital means. Elizabeth Stokoe joins the program now. Elizabeth, welcome.
Hi, nice to be with you.
Thank you so much for coming on the program. Let's talk first of all about the COVID-19 and impacts of COVID-19 on conversation. How has communication changed due to COVID-19?
Well, right from the start of the pandemic, we found ourselves kind of having to do different things to even have to start a conversation off. So, for example, it's kind of normal in pre-pandemic times to start a conversation by saying, "How are you? Fine. How are you? Fine." And quite quickly, we all found ourselves not being able to say that at the start of the conversation without really meaning it. So all of a sudden, rather than being those kind of things that you almost throw away at the start of the conversation, "How are you?" became the whole purpose for getting in touch. And so, you know, right from the start, you could see these structural shifts in the way we open conversations. And of course, you know, lots of other things like having to navigate new norms like social distancing and mask wearing and all sorts of things like that, right from the start of the pandemic, made us adapt to the new situation.
Has online, you know, there's been a lot of Zoom and Teams meetings and Google meetings. Has the online conversation also changed not just the way in which we introduce ourselves, but also the way in which we talk and the way in which we use our body communication, you know, the way in which we communicate without actually using words themselves, which normally people might do in a one-on-one conversation but can't do now online, right?
Well, we're on the radio, so I'm hoping that we're managing pretty well without any body language right now because no one can see us. I think it's a great question, actually, because it really does make us think about what we mean when we say, you know, in person versus face to face versus remote interaction and so on. And I think it really depends what we're doing, the modality that is best for the encounter. And obviously, the pandemic also accelerated a lot of trends that were already in train. So we found ourselves doing a lot of interaction online, but we were kind of already starting to do it more and more. So, yes, I think online communication is something that we've all got rapidly used to. And I think the other thing to keep remembering when we are asking ourselves this question is it's quite different to have to interact online and on Zoom than choosing to do it. And so one of the things that we know from looking at the way people interact online is that some of the things might be quite similar in terms of what people are doing. So they're still greeting each other and asking each other questions and running meetings and having doctor's appointments. But of course, when you ask people how they feel about it, you're asking them in a situation of a global pandemic. And that isn't the same as choosing to do it. You know, video calling has absolutely enabled astonishing feats of communication, including during the pandemic. I mean, I can't imagine not having access to video calling my family, both in the UK where I'm based and also, you know, around the world. So, I think it's not an all or nothing kind of modality, and we need to be kind of careful what we're asking when we think about these questions.
And also the ability to have group conversations. I mean, your ability to be able to have many people in a conversation at the same time is completely different in person than it is online. In person, you're able to use arm gestures and almost signal to someone to say, you know, there you are and it's your turn to talk and kind of thing. Whereas online, I mean, it's almost like we're all jumping over each other because no one's really sure when to get in and when to say their bit, which obviously is a much more difficult, complex way of trying to hold a conversation.
Yeah, I think actually both sorts of encounters need some thought. So we've all been in terrible meetings in person where the chair apparently you can't catch their eye, and someone else might say, "Oh, Liz has been trying to get in for the last 15 minutes." And we're, that is also the kind of thing that we're navigating now online. So I think there are lots of things that we can do to adapt to it, whatever resources we have for interacting. And perhaps one of the most important things to think about is whether you're interacting on a Teams meeting or in person, what you really want is for everyone to have a sort of parity of resources for interacting. So if you're in a meeting and it's in a terribly echoey room and you can't really hear the people at the other end of the room, then that isn't going to be a great experience. And yes, and also if you're on a Zoom and the chair or whoever isn't really paying attention to people's inability to know whose eye they might be trying to catch, because you can't do that kind of selection of the next speaker with gaze on Teams. That's for sure. Both of them though come down to careful, thoughtful communication. I would argue that good communicators make for good communication, and being in person is no guarantee of having a great first date or having a great doctor's appointment or being in a great meeting. Otherwise, there wouldn't be, endless stuff written about how to have a good first date and how to run a great meeting. So again, I think it's there's more nuance in some of these questions than we might initially think.
I was going to say that some of those terrible meetings actually happen in person as well, right? Depending on the ability and the effectiveness of the person
Exactly.
chairing a meeting to be able to conduct a meeting in the first place. So sometimes those transferable things happen online no matter what the situation might be. What, in your view, makes an effective conversation then?
I think it's kind of moving through the interaction with minimum friction, minimum misunderstanding, minimum having to sort of go back and do it all again, and being really attentive to the people that are in the room and what they already know and what they need to know to participate, and being inclusive and so on. So those are the things that I think create an effective communication, thinking about your recipients, what they know, what they might need to know to participate. And I think it'll be really interesting to see if we can somehow manage to transfer some of the things that we have been able to do online. For example, people are already reporting, and there's bits and pieces of research showing that some people feel more able to participate in a Teams meeting because they can write something in the chat and they would never have spoken, in a meeting. So it can be a bit more democratizing. And, if you've got it, I think it reduces hierarchies as well. And so how are we going to preserve those kinds of things back in face-to-face meetings? How are we going to manage, sharing links and sharing files and all the things that are actually quite good about the online interaction?
You have also said, I think, that the view that 93% of communication is non-verbal is a myth. And I really like some help here, because when you wear a face mask, and in New Zealand you have to wear a face mask on the plane, and when the flight attendants are coming around to give you a cup of tea or a coffee, and they put their hand out to say, "What would you like?" Trying to communicate what you'd like, particularly if you're 3 seats in, is really difficult. You've got to use hand signals and anything like that, because they can't often hear, because of the hum of the plane, they can't often hear what you're saying. So when you say that non-verbal communication, or that 93% of communication is non-verbal, is a myth, how does that work for things like when you're wearing face masks, or when two people are wearing face masks and trying to have a conversation? It's awfully difficult.
So I think we sort of need to go back to basics here, and people may or may not be aware that that statistic emerged out of a misreading of some research from both the 60s and the 80s, conducted by a man called Albert Mehrabian, who himself campaigned with a sociologist later in the 90s to stop people using this non-finding from his research. But of course, sometimes things that sound plausible just pass out of the realm of any kind of evidence, and it just becomes something we all assert about interaction. But so first of all, I would say again, we're on the radio now, and I'm hoping that your listeners can understand pretty much, 100% of what we're saying, despite the fact they have no access to our bodies. We wouldn't be at Max Atkinson, who was the person who interviewed Mehrabian, pointed out that we wouldn't be able to talk on the in the dark. We wouldn't be able to well, we would be able to manage in countries where we don't speak the language for 93% of the time if 93% of communication was conducted through our bodies. So I think that there's a kind of strange starting point for all this, on which other arguments get built on these kind of shaky foundations. When it comes to masks, of course, what you are doing is reducing, you know, the resources that people have for interacting, but it quickly becomes something that again needs more careful nuance. So are we saying that you know, people who wear face coverings for all sorts of reasons can't interact with each other? I was really struck by looking at a couple of television programs during the pandemic, but that had been filmed before the pandemic. Grey's Anatomy is one of my favorites. And I was struck by how many scenes are kind of filmed in the operating theater with all these medics kind of flirting with just their eyes and eyebrows, you know, over the top of their masks, and thinking, well, those scenes weren't cut. They kind of have a lot of scenes where people are doing all sorts with their masks on. So of course, again, it's not a straightforward all or nothing kind of thing. Yes, we have reduced access to our whole faces for interacting, but it's not impossible. And again, humans have, we're using all different sort of bits of our bodies and voice and intonation, and all of those things are all in combination, and we don't have access to all of them all of the time.
You're listening to RNZ National on Saturday morning. It's 10 to 9. I'm Julian Wilcox filling in for Kim Hill, who will be back next week. We're speaking with Elizabeth Stoker, who is a professor of social interaction at Loughborough University. Elizabeth, those in the wild conversations that you will have recorded and listened to must be fascinating. I mean, the first dates one would be, I don't know, awkward, funny.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. I kind of stopped. I only ever wrote one main thing about the first date stuff that I looked at, because I thought, well, I don't want to become the professor of first dates forevermore. But they were fascinating. And I looked at speed dates, because people have to do this thing in 5 minutes, get to know each other and then move on. And so they're really lovely to analyze, because you have to do a lot of work in 5 minutes to try to get to know somebody. But yeah, it's the kind of USP of the kind of science of communication that conversation analysis is a part of. And conversation analysts, on principle, if you like, study real conversation in the wild, not experimentally produced, not role played. We don't interview people or survey people about their experiences. We look at recordings, audio and video recordings that are of encounters that would have happened if a researcher wasn't present. So as you say, I've looked at everything from police interviews with suspects that are recorded anyway, loads of call center stuff that gets recorded anyway, you know, to first dates, which did get recorded by the participants who consented, but were going to happen anyway. And it's really important to look at what people are doing when they're doing the things that really matter to them, that they have sort of chosen to do today, not trying to reproduce for a researcher. And it's amazing what you can find when you look properly at what people are doing, rather than kind of getting them to role play it, and then it all becomes rather stereotypical.
You've also talked about filler words, words like well and similar kind of words like that. What are the purpose of filler words? I mean, I listen to TV and radio a lot and other news, and when people ask a question, you hear a lot of people respond immediately with a word like, well, and then they start the answer. What is the purpose of filler words?
They have different functions, but well is a nice example of what typically starts a turn at talk that is going to be a bit less straightforward than might have been anticipated by asking the question. So if you say something like, do you like cake, and someone says well, then you know that it's not going to be a yes or a no straightforward kind of response. And so we see that things like well are used systematically. They're not random, they're not arbitrary, they're fulfilling a function that is incredibly ordinary, actually, and just very common. And my filler words now, you know, like ums and ahs and so on, it's pretty hard to talk without them, and they're necessary. But again, they're sort of systematically doing things when you study the granular level of social interaction. So they might be doing things like displaying to the person you're talking to, I'm searching for a word that I've temporarily forgotten. Or they might even be sort of place before words that you're not sure of or that you're not sure you're entitled to use. So, for example, you might see people doing ums and ers before a technical word that they think that the person they're talking to is kind of more entitled to say than they are. And they're showing a sort of, you know, I'm not an expert in this, so I'm going to slightly soften my use of this word and not sound too arrogant. But the most important thing to note again is that filler word itself as a description is a bit of a misnomer, because what conversation analysis shows is that every single one of these things that we might write off as not really belonging or kind of extra or a mistake are actually serving particular interactional functions.
Are we losing the art of conversation here, Elizabeth? Or has conversation simply just evolved and developed to fit a contemporary context, a current context?
I think it's the latter. Yes, I think conversation and words and language itself is constantly on the move. And I think at the moment, you know, we're obviously quite focused on the difference between in-person and online, you know, video mediated interaction. And it's obvious why people are focused on that. But I'm always drawn to things like what about when the telephone was sort of first invented, and you know, perhaps some people felt equally like, oh, this is terrible, this telephone device which doesn't enable us to hug each other, but you know, tremendous work goes on the phone. And I think about things like helplines, the Samaritans, people who are phoning up crisis lines, and what tremendous work gets done on the phone, where you know, it feels like it's a reduced modality, but in fact we don't really think of it that way anymore. We just think there are a range of ways of interacting, there, you know, more than ever before, and they all serve a different purpose. You know, people can fall in love online. They can't hook each other yet online, at least as far as I'm aware. But I think we're kind of safe that humans are very social. In a way, we might not be, you know, complaining so much or worrying at the problem of online interaction if we didn't really want to affiliate and interact with each other. So we've never been more connected, and we just keep adapting our fundamental practices to the environment that we're in.
The reason I ask that question is I wonder if, and you would have seen the Friends reunion, and I understand you love the program and are a bit of a fan of it, but the Friends reunion that happened a couple of weeks ago, we saw it in New Zealand, and I was going to ask whether or not Friends would work now as it did in the 90s, because you've researched this and have had a look at the clever conversational devices that the Friends script writers used, invitations and dispreferred responses. And I wonder if that would continue to be as popular now using those same devices in the script writing in 2021 as it did in the 1990s.
I think the basic principle of creating humour through embracing the unexpected, which is what a lot of the scripts of Friends do, would still work to generate humour, because we do it ourselves in a way. You know, one of the things that we just do as regular, you know, people chatting is build up an expectation to something and then, you know, pull the rug out, and in fact you're going somewhere else, and that can be funny. So I think the because Friends script writers were, if you like, only adapting something that you could or was already existing, then I think those fundamentals will remain the same. Whether or not you know, Friends would work now, I can't comment. I watch very little sitcom types of telly these days. So some colleagues tell me that other programs use a similar kind of device. So there's something called the Big Bang Theory. I've never seen it, but apparently they do a lot of the same types of humor generation. And actually, I met some of these colleagues yesterday online, and we were talking about the laugh track, actually, because one of the other things about Friends is I don't know always whether it's in front of a live studio audience or canned laughter, but certainly what you do have is laughter. And one of the things that's interesting about the Friends transcripts when you make them is that you include the laughter as part of the transcript, as evidence of what you're meant to find funny, if you like. So one of the, you know, favorite clips is from the very first episode, where Rachel is invited to go and help put some furniture together for Ross, and she says, well, I that'd be great, but actually I'm just going to stay here and it's been a long day, and no one laughs. And then they ask Phoebe the question, the sort of wacky character, do you want to come and put furniture together? And she says, oh, I'd love to, but I don't want to. And then everyone laughs, and it's the laughter, whether, you know, in a way it doesn't really matter whether you like Friends or find it funny or not, the point is that that's where the laughter occurs. And so it's the in the why is it there? And it's there because of the breach, and we can all recognize that. So yeah, I think it I think the sort of fundamental mechanism for generating humor will never really go away, whether or not Friends itself, you know, there's lots of criticism of Friends and so on, and that's, I think that's fair enough. Everything moves on, but perhaps not the fundamentals of interaction.
Elizabeth, thank you so much for coming on the program. So many more questions to ask. We're going to have to invite you back on with Kim at some stage, but really appreciate you coming on this morning and being open to the questions that we put to you. All the best for the future, and thank you again.
Thank you.
Elizabeth Stokoe there. She is the professor of social interaction at Loughborough University.